Good afternoon. It's Wednesday, the 20th February 2019, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. Your host today, Mike Robinson, myself, Brian Gerrish. We're delighted to be joined by Mark Anderson from Stop the Presses. And of course, Mark speaking to us from the USA.
Right, we're going to get to start off with Jeremy Hunt, our favourite Foreign Secretary, who was speaking at the Konrad Adenauer Stiftung dare to go. So here he is. There are moments in history, he says, that remind us that we are part of something greater than ourselves. As I landed at Tegel Airport this morning, I thought of one such moment. And he went on to talk about the Berlin airlift. He said it was a fantastic operation. The people of Berlin built the Tegel Airport with their own hands, taking only 90 days to construct what was then the longest runway in Europe. Our countries were just a few years away from a devastating war, and yet we were united, united by shared values and united in opposition to those who sought to destroy those values. Then we overcame an ordeal, just like Brexit. So if that isn't enough to have made you throw up your lunch, he went on and he said this. We are bound together not simply by institutions, but by beliefs that inspired the creation of those institutions: direct democracy, openness and equality before the law, regardless of race, class, gender and sexuality. Okay, equality before the law. I think Prince Philip managed to dodge that one. But anyway, okay, we don't need to follow the rules that we encourage others to follow, I suppose. He said that Britain and Germany cherish the same freedoms, defend the same values, respect the same fundamental laws and face the same dangers. And so we're bound together, not simply by institutions and so on. We are open societies, apparently. And then he went on to say, whether through our European friends, our Atlantic allies or the Commonwealth family, Britain after Brexit will seek to bind the democracies of the world together. So that makes me feel a lot better about things. He said that there's much to celebrate. Our diplomats are training side by side. This is British and German diplomats. Only last week, 76 British and German diplomats were attending joint classes in the Foreign Office in London. This is brilliant. Britain and Germany getting together. Now, I have asked the Foreign Office to clarify what this was, because there doesn't seem to have been any press release about it. Well, we don't know yet. They haven't responded. He went on to say, the future partnership that Britain seeks to build with the EU starts with the belief that our security is indivisible. Our security is indivisible, Brian. And that is because although we're leaving the European Union, the Prime Minister has restated that Britain's commitment to the defence of Europe is immovable and unconditional. And he said that some in Germany have seen our decision to leave the EU as a retreat from the global stage and from common European security interests. Nothing could be further from the truth. So if you remember on Monday, we were looking at this diagram and we were showing the treaties that have been created in the last few years outside the European Union to form the basis of European Defence Union. So we've got Britain and France with the Lancaster House Treaty, the Sandhurst Treaties, and of course the ongoing activities of the Franco-British Council. We've got France and Germany with the Aachen Treaty, and we've got Britain and Germany with the Joint Vision Statement on Defence from last October. But what's clear from Jeremy Hunt's speech is that he wants to take this a lot further. So Britain and France and Germany have established, well, what could we call it? A troika, perhaps? A troika which underpins EU Defence Union despite Brexit. And this is the key point, because this exists outside the treaties that already exist for the European Union. And so this organisation sort of duplicates those treaties in a certain sense. Why would they want to do that? Maybe they think that the EU itself is under some kind of existential threat from Brexit and other exit type initiatives in other countries. But the key phrase that Jeremy Hunt made was, our defence is indivisible, our defence. And I just want to remind you what Gavin Williamson was saying at the Munich Security Conference at the weekend, as he and Ursula von der Leyen had agreed when they met at NATO earlier in the week, Europeans should not be spending 2% of GDP on defence for America. They should be spending it for ourselves and our security. Us is the message. We are leaving Brexit without the exit because it's us with respect to Britain and the EU.
Yeah, there's a lot to comment on there, Mike, but this that last piece there where he's talking about we shouldn't be spending on the defence of America, when have we ever spent money to defend America? I'm racking my brains to think of when we have actually spent money where we're actually saying we are doing this, we're building this capability in order to help defend America. I've never heard it. I never heard it in my military career. I've never read it. I've never seen anything about it. So this is an invented term, which I think is part of the smokescreen to say what we're doing here is European defence, which is coming through. Brexit, of course, is just froth on the surface underneath. We're being linked in. And you've picked up the use of we and our. This is nothing to do with Britain or British politics. This is an elite political class, pan-European class, talking to each other. But spending money to defend America has never happened.
No, and I mean you make a good point there. And of course, that is a very important point because defence is not part of the Brexit discussion. The reason for that is that while our future relationship with the EU, whatever happens with Brexit at the end of March, our future relationship with the EU has not yet been negotiated. We don't know what that is going to be, except in the area of defence, because we know exactly how that is going to be. Just look at the timeline on the UK Column website for how that has developed over the last few decades, and you'll see what agreements are already in place. So defence outside of the whole Brexit negotiation at the moment.
And we'll just push at this point that it's clear, it's becoming more and more obvious, that of course the bulk of our members of Parliament have no idea that these things are being put together. They don't see them, they don't see how they connect together, they don't see the web being built. So if you're not actually as part of the cabinet team, you're a backbencher, you are simply cannon fodder in the classroom as far as these agreements go. It is quite extraordinary to see just the immense ignorance of our MPs, but more on that a little bit later, I think.
Well, while there's lots of rhetoric in the press about Britain not being prepared, clearly we are prepared with respect to defence. One other area that we seem to be getting prepared for is policing. So another aspect of security here. So the Home Secretary on Monday was visiting two police hubs, as they're being described, to see how law enforcement is preparing for the probability, possibility, maybe leaving the EU without a deal. So here's Sajid Javid there. He was given a tour of the International Crime and Coordination Centre. This is a unit which was set up recently by the National Police Chiefs Council and therefore falls under the auspices of the wonderful Chief Constable Sarah Thornton, who is the NPCC chair. Now, the International Crime and Coordination Centre is going to act as a centre of expertise, apparently to support police forces in using alternative cooperation mechanisms with European partners should a deal not be agreed before we leave the EU. It's not clear what those alternative cooperation mechanisms are just yet, but there must be some arrangement under the surface. The other hub that Sajid Javid went to visit was the National Police Coordination Centre, and he was given an overview of that by Sarah Thornton, and this was launched in 2013. The National Police Coordination Centre apparently coordinates the deployment of police officers and staff during major events and operations, for example, perhaps any kind of civil unrest with respect to Brexit. So that's good. Everything in place there. What did Sajid Javid have to say? The UK's main objective is to maintain existing levels of security cooperation and protect mutually beneficial capabilities, which is in the interests of both Britain and the EU. So don't worry, Brian, it's Brexit without the exit.
It's Brexit without the exit. So if that's the reality of what's going on out of sight of the public, that the defence, the EU defence union is being built by the hour, by the day, let's have a look at what the MPs are doing. And we've had the announcement that we've now got three Conservative MPs who have left the party. They've rejected the whip. Anna Soubry, Heidi Allen and Sarah Wollaston. Sarah Wollaston, of course, is a local MP to us. They've all quit the Conservative Party. And what have they been saying? Well, there's lots of words. We're only able to take out some of it, but this is part of their joint statement. Following the EU referendum of 2016, no genuine effort was made to build a cross-party, let alone a national consensus to deliver Brexit. Instead of seeking to heal the divisions or to tackle the underlying causes of Brexit, the priority was to draw up red lines. The 48% were not only sidelined, they were alienated. Beautiful spin there, Mike, because we focus on the minority, not the majority, who wanted to come out, and that hasn't happened. But we put the spin onto the other side. And then there was this paragraph. This shift to the right has been exacerbated by blatant entryism. Not only has this been tolerated, it's been actively welcomed in some quarters. A purple momentum is subsuming the Conservative Party, much as the hard left has been allowed to consume and terminally undermine the Labour Party. Well, I wondered what this new language was. You were kind enough to tell me what entryism is. And if I've got it correctly, it's you join something, but it's trying to draw you into something bigger.
Right.
So is she talking about the EU here or not? I don't know. But then we've got this fantastic purple momentum, which sounds a little bit dubious. I'm not sure what she's talking about there. What do you think she's discussing?
I have no idea. Purple revolution, perhaps. So this was something that we got hints of a couple of years ago. Everything painted purple.
Yeah.
We're turning the world upside down and turning it purple.
We've got MPs who have not got a clue what is really being done within their own government, but they're now using this new speak language. Do they even understand the words coming out of their own mouth? I'm not sure. Let's have a look at Sarah Wollaston, because we did get hold of her whole letter. We've taken a couple of excerpts here. Let's read them. She said this: we've reached a precarious moment in our national life. Nothing has divided us like Brexit, and we now face the serious prospect of crashing out of the EU in less than 40 days' time with no deal and no transition. This would not be a clean Brexit, as some have chosen to represent it. The serious real-world consequences would harm people, not only in this constituency, but across the whole of the UK and beyond. We're already seeing clear evidence of the consequences for people working in companies like Honda, Jaguar, Land Rover, Nissan, Dyson, Fly BMI, Panasonic, and for sectors like the pharmaceutical industry following the relocation of expertise and jobs with the European Medicines Agency. It's also starting to hit local businesses. Now, when I read through this paragraph initially, I thought this is just amazing. The whole thing is about blackmail, threats, blackmail and intimidation to UK, largely by foreign-owned companies. And we are supposed to roll over and say that we're now such a sixth-rate nation that we can't control our own production, our own industry. And if somebody else has got a better rule for us, we've got to follow that. But you picked up on the Nissan thing.
What she's saying is absolutely untrue. Nissan and Honda have removed production from the UK and taken it back to Japan. Was that anything to do with Brexit? Absolutely not. What has happened in the meantime, in the last week or so, is that the EU and Japan have signed an economic partnership agreement. It has now entered into force in the last few days. As you can see on screen, biggest agreement ever negotiated. It's an open trade zone covering 635 million people. So the point is that there is no need for Japanese companies to manufacture within the European Union anymore, because the tariffs that they would have experienced by trying to import goods from Japan into the EU no longer exist. They've done their own trade deal with the EU, and they've simply taken a business decision to move manufacturing back to Japan. So this has got nothing whatever to do with Brexit. In fact, you know, I'd be interested to know what the limitations are on the blame for things happening as a result of Brexit. It seems that there are no...
I think anything that happens in the country now and in the foreseeable future will be blamed on Brexit. That will just be the message. I'll just add that, of course, Sarah Wollaston brings in the pharmaceutical industry in her letter. I think I'm right in saying that one of the areas that she's never given any support to was GCMAF. And there's some rather dubious manoeuvring around David Noakes's imprisonment over GCMAF. And I believe statements that Sarah Wollaston made. Now, we need to do a little bit more research into that, but there's certainly a little bit of grey area. Let's just give a little bit more about what she said. She said this: the Labour Party has also changed beyond repair. It's now permanently in the grip of the hard left and tainted by its failure to root out anti-Semitism. These are some of the reasons why several of its MEPs have already decided that they too must resign the whip. I will be sitting alongside them in a new centre grouping of independent MPs who share a common set of values. Great expression, that. Common purpose. The independent group. We agree with the millions of people who feel that neither main political party represents them, and there needs to be a new offer at the heart of our politics. So she's brought in the anti-Semitism. Let's have a look at this MP who resigned from Labour, Joan Ryan. She quit Labour for the independent group. This is what she said. She said that she was horrified, appalled and angered by Labour's failure to tackle anti-Semitism, saying its leadership allowed Jews to be abused with impunity. That's pretty strong language. Now, the BBC thought that it was an important thing. If we just bring it up here, the BBC points out that she was chair of Labour Friends of Israel. So this is not exactly a unbiased comment from this woman, because she's sitting in a position where part of her job is to promote Israel. But where is this abuse happening? Mike, because this claim is now being made everywhere. And I just wonder where it is. I'll bring this little bit up because I've used it with David Cameron. But where does this lady's loyalty lie? Is it with Israel or is it with UK? Because you can't have two masters.
I believe it is with Israel. And of course, the allegations of anti-Semitism are nothing whatever to do with hate crimes against Jews or criticism of Jews or hatred of Jews. It's about Zionism and the foreign policy of the nation of Israel. It's about their treatment of the Palestinians. And any suggestion that that equates to hatred of Jews as individuals or people in the UK that are Jewish is complete nonsense. So this is disingenuous at best. But, you know, what is this centrist party all about, Brian? Well, of course, as we mentioned on Monday and several months ago as well, Tony Blair is behind this. He has been arguing for several months and has had quite a bit of coverage on BBC to promote this idea of a new centrist party. It looks like he has managed to get a handful of people from the Labour Party, a handful of people from the Conservative Party to come together to create that centrist party. The question is, can they build any momentum to actually make it a credible force? Well, we haven't seen this type of thing succeed very well in the past.
It's true. But one thing we can be sure of, they're going to have access to huge amounts of money to build whatever they're building. And of course, he's stayed in the background because he knows he's a kiss of death to any public political activity. So he's manipulating in the background.
Yeah. OK, now a couple of advertisements. First of all, if you like what we're doing at the UK Column and you'd like to support us, please join the UK Column community. You can do that by going to ukcolumn.org/community. Now, later on, Vanessa Bailey has been interviewed by Afshin Rattanzi for Going Underground. Let's just have a quick look at a trailer for that.
The White Helmets, who we will get in touch with, would say, as a humanitarian organisation, this isn't necessarily organ theft. These are organs that, as part of dying civilians because of the Assad regime. This is why that may have appeared to seem like organ trafficking.
That would be an extraordinary reasoning for the taking of children with very light injuries, as have been described to me, to the Turkish border. And then the children's bodies are returned basically with the familiar stitching from top to bottom of the torso, and the organs have clearly been removed. This was a UN Security Council panel where the evidence was presented that had been gathered with hundreds of interviews with civilians, not only in East Aleppo but also in Eastern Ghouta. I myself have a number of interviews and testimonies that I gathered from civilians, particularly in East Aleppo, but also in Eastern Ghouta, who spoke to me of the White Helmets abducting children, using them for staging of various chemical attacks, chlorine gas attacks, and also taking them to centres for organ extraction.
So if you'd like to see more of that, of course, you can watch it on RT at 2:30 p.m. this afternoon live and also 9:30 p.m. tonight. And of course, that interview will appear in full on RT's YouTube channel in due course. Another quick reminder of AV9.1 DVDs available on the UK Column website. Brian's presentation, Alex Thompson, Patrick Henningsen, Dr. Graham Downing and Ian R. Crane. Well worth the effort to get hold of those DVDs to watch those presentations. And also Ian wanted me to just mention that I think there are only 15 residential spaces left for AV10. So if you're interested in going to AV10, you need to get hold of tickets very soon. Now, unfortunately, we haven't got the advertisement for the 5G event taking place next weekend in Belfast Lee.
Yeah, 22nd at 7:30 in the evening.
Ian will be speaking at that, actually, so he mentioned that to me today as well. So Ian will be speaking at that event. We'll have more details on Friday's programme. Now, let's welcome Mark Anderson to the programme. Mark, let's get started with this city's agenda, because, you know, something that we've been trying to highlight for quite a time now is that while all this other stuff is going on with respect to Brexit, with all the furore over Donald Trump and so on, we're increasingly seeing governance being taken out of the hands of national governments and placed in the hands of city mayors and so on. And one of the main drivers for this has been the climate change policy. So tell us a little about what the Chicago Council for Global Affairs has been up to on this.
Well, what's been happening is, as you might recall, guys, and I reported this on UK Column and elsewhere, in late December 2017, the North American Climate Summit happened under Michael Bloomberg's Global Covenant of Mayors for Climate and Energy. While I was waiting for the other shoe to drop, they did have the Climate Action Summit in San Francisco last year that was sort of an outgrowth of what happened at that climate summit in Chicago. But the real big movement just happened on Valentine's Day at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs in downtown Chicago, where Mayor Rahm Emanuel, who's finishing up his mayoralship there, he's beginning to move on. He's really the main driver in North America and possibly around the world for carrying this Global Cities Forum forward, this Global Cities movement. And what they're doing is something called Resilient Chicago. Resilient Chicago is coming in tandem with an announcement by him, Emmanuel, and Michael Berkowitz of the Rockefeller Foundation to say that now climate change is not enough. Even though this is an outgrowth of the climate summit, climate change and doing everything they can to correct or avoid global warming, that's not enough. Now it has to permeate across all institutions. And so Resilient Chicago, while it has a major climate element in the scheme, is really about changing and molding and merging institutions all the way across the board. In fact, what I'm seeing is evidence that it's the public and private sectors themselves will begin to blur the whole.
We just lost your microphone there, Mark, I'm afraid.
Oh my goodness.
You're back. You're back. You've gone again.
Loose connection.
Yeah, sorry, that seems like a loose connection, I'm afraid, Mark. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh.
No, I'm sorry. We're going to have to leave it
just,
because
so you want to try.
Yeah, that is
just
a loose connection at your end. Yeah, it keeps dropping out. Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm afraid we're going to have to move on, unfortunately, because
That's fine. I'll just follow up what Mark's just said about, and we've got another segment coming up in this news, which is very much on this same subject, that you're seeing this blurring between the government, the non-governmental organisations, the charities. We've talked about this,
yes,
the so-called third sector before, but it's fascinating that here's Mark picking up on the same agenda coming through in America. So is this part of the new rules-based order we're catching glimpses of?
Well, it is the fusion doctrine. Everything is merging into one thing. Do you want to just give it one more go, Mark?
How am I doing? 1, 2, 3.
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay, well.
And we can't hear you. Yeah, okay. Look, I'm really sorry. we're going to have to leave it. Now, let's see. Where are we? Yes, artificial intelligence. A new code of conduct for the use of artificial intelligence systems within the National Health Service. So this is all about artificial intelligence and other data-driven technologies, which are going to ensure, apparently, that only the best and safest systems are used by the NHS. The code encourages technology companies to meet a gold standard set of principles to protect patient data to the highest standards. It's being drawn up with the help of industry, academics and patient groups. The aim is to make it easier for suppliers to develop technologies that tackle some of the best issues in healthcare. Well, let's have a look at what the code will do. It will promote the UK as the best place in the world to invest in health tech, provide evidence of what good practice looks like to industry and commissioners, and reassure patients and clinicians that data-driven technology is safe, effective and maintains privacy. So it's going to promote the idea, Brian, that the UK is the best place in the world to invest in health tech. Health tech now becomes a brand like fintech, it's about investments and profits. It's not about looking after people.
Profit, absolutely the word, because we're seeing profit now coming out and being stated in a number of documents about the NHS. So it's no longer a public service. And of course, we said it was being privatised, which it is.
Yeah, and let's see. They say that it will allow government to work with suppliers to guide the development of new technology so products are suitable for the NHS in the future. And it will make sure the NHS gets a fair deal from the commercialisation of its data resources. So we're going to sell that data. We're going to do it in the right way, but we're going to sell the data, and the NHS is apparently going to benefit commercially from that. I'm not sure that will filter down to actual public health benefits. But anyway, AI technology is already being used across the NHS, apparently, and they wanted to highlight in their press release three examples of that. The Moorfields DeepMind, this is 1 million anonymized eye scans, which are shared with DeepMind under a research agreement that began in mid-2016. DeepMind's algorithm is designed to find early signs of age-related macular degeneration, diabetes, retinopathy. The John Radcliffe Hospital, working with their partner Ultromics to use AI to improve detection of heart disease and lung cancer. Those sound fine. But the third one, Imperial College London, they have developed a new AI system that could predict the survival rates for patients with ovarian cancer. Now, people may say that I'm overly conspiratorial or overly cynical or whatever, but I read that and I immediately thought with what was, okay, that's a little bit disturbing. So does that mean that for anybody that the AI decides is not likely to survive, that those people will not obtain proper treatment? And in fact, that seems to be exactly the case. So here's the Evening Standard. The headline is, this is from 3 days ago, AI program at Imperial College could improve survival rate of ovarian cancer patients. They say London researchers have developed an artificial intelligence computer program that is up to 4 times better than doctors at predicting which women are likely to die from ovarian cancer. The breakthrough at Imperial College paves the way for patients to receive the most effective treatment and could improve survival from a disease that kills about 4,300 UK women a year. But it was this sentence, at predicting which women are likely to die from ovarian cancer. Not the focus of that sentence is not about survival or treatment, it's about death. I suspect I'm possibly not being overly too cynical when I suggest that that this is not necessarily a positive development.
Well, the first thing we need to ask ourselves is who are the people behind the project and what's their morality? What sort of people are they? And are they driving for profit or to make people who are sick better? And I think I know the answer to it. But thank you very much to one of our viewers that gave us a heads up on this one. It's Sheffield Hallam University, and it's an organisation called Centric, which is alongside, it is buried in the university. And what is Centric? It's a centre of excellence in terrorism, resilience, intelligence and organised crime research. So this is where we start to say, what are our universities about? Are they really teaching people? Well, what we're starting to see here is a merge with central government. But let's follow it through. It says Centric is a multidisciplinary and end-user centric research body located within Cultural Communication and Computing Research Institute, that's C3RI at Sheffield Hallam University. The strategic aim of Centric is to facilitate the triangulation between the four key stakeholders in the security domain: citizens, law enforcement agencies, industry and academia. So apparently those are all now working together to protect us. Well, not quite. The mission of Centric is to provide a platform for researchers, practitioners, policymakers, and the public to focus on applied research in the security domain. The centre's activities will be firmly underpinned by due cooperation.
No, consideration.
Consideration, thank you, for citizen perspectives, the interests and engagement of all end users, as well as key societal issues and relevant ethical issues. So this is all pretty amazing stuff. What are we going to be doing? Well, let's have a look. The staff and partners of Centric have strong applied orientation and a proven track record in the following topics: communication and knowledge modelling for crisis management, cyber terrorism, understanding the origins and expression of contemporary dissent. That's a very interesting one. Knowledge and intelligence management to combat terrorism. Semantic information mining and formal concept analysis, social media analysis, security, society and citizens, on it goes, and it ends up with 3D face recognition. So this is like having a government intelligence service hub buried in a university, Mike. But of course it's money making, so it's got its own website. We can go here, Centre of Intelligence Centric. And as I usually do, I go to look at people. I was only able to do this very quickly, but my question is, who are these people? There's CVs, you can have a look at their track record. Top left, we've got Professor Achar, who seems to be the lead professor on the organisation. But we've got retired policemen, we've got security people, we've got some of the big social media corporations involved. Who are these people and what are they really doing here? But something I think very nasty is being built, which is essentially an intelligence hub lost within a university. We don't really see it. It's hidden in plain sight, but they are there to ensure our security. I don't get a warm feeling.
Well, it's been a pretty busy time in the last couple of weeks with respect to disinformation following the Integrity Initiative exposure and so on. We've had the Cairncross Commission report. We've had the report on disinformation and fake news from the Digital Culture, Media and Sports Select Committee. And, well, it gets better because this, of course, has been a long-standing campaign by the government. If it's unacceptable offline, then it's unacceptable online. But this is Secretary of State for Digital Culture, Media and Sport, Jeremy Wright, and also the Digital Minister, Margot James, heading over to the United States this week to discuss with the tech companies the fact that they need to take more responsibility in tackling what are being described as online harms to make the internet safer. So they'll be meeting with Facebook, Twitter, Google and Apple. And of course, this comes ahead of the government's internet safety white paper, which undoubtedly is going to reinforce exactly the same narratives that the Cairn Cross Commission report and the Digital Culture, Media and Sports Select Committee report have highlighted, which is to put the onus on the social media companies, even potentially with statutory backing, to require them to censor particular organisations. Now, as we mentioned on Monday, with respect to the report from the Digital Culture, Media and Sports Select Committee, what they seem to be suggesting is that there would be a list of proscribed organisations, as if they were terrorist organisations, just like terrorist organisations, a list of proscribed organisations that the social media companies would be have a statutory requirement to remove from their platforms. Well, anyway, Jeremy Wright had this to say: with power comes responsibility, and the time has come for tech companies to be properly accountable. Well, I think the same, if you replace tech companies with members of parliament, you might be able to say this, make the same comment justifiably at the moment, because there seems to be a government which is operating without any concerns about accountability at all at the moment.
Yes, and everybody else is to be accountable to that government. So the government itself, totally unaccountable, but everybody must be accountable
absolutely.
To it.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, if they're putting all these systems in place to help control fake news, amongst other things, let's just have a look at this. Now, this article, I should have a date on it, but it's going back somewhere near the beginning of last year. And The Guardian had an article where it was saying that the US military was getting spooked because they'd realised that so many of their troops were using devices which could be tracked in some way. It could be their mobile phone or it could be a fitness device. And of course, people were able to collect this data. And this was revealing interesting stuff. It could reveal where troops were going outside a base for an exercise jog. And that, of course, was a security risk itself, or the sheer intensity of the intercepts and the positioning could identify that a particular base in a foreign country was being particularly heavily used. So the Guardian article was pointing out that the US was military was very concerned about the ability of phones and data from phones to reveal what it was up to. It wasn't only the Guardian, there were other sites that picked up on this, and I've just chosen this one to emphasize that other people were talking about this. US military officials were recently caught off guard by revelations that service members' digital fitness trackers were storing the location of their workouts, including near military bases and clandestine sites around the world. So the story is quite factual. The equipment exists, people are using them, and they're actually starting to breach military secrecy as far as Americans are concerned. But when The Guardian reports the Russians also banning phones for exactly the same reason, the story is spun in a very different direction. So here's The Guardian: Russia moves to mask its soldiers' digital trail with smartphone ban. Investigative sites have used social media posts to confirm Russia's involvement in conflicts. So here's the dirty pen at work, because this is not the Russians saying we're going to stop mobile phone data for exactly the same reason as the Americans. No, this phone data has shown those nasty Russians up to clandestine things in other countries. In fact, what they said was this: Russia is banning mobile phones from the military to hide their, quote, secret participation in foreign conflicts. Now, if you get into the article itself, it gets interesting, because here's that statement: Russia's parliament has voted to ban its soldiers from using smartphones and social networks after a series of, quote, open source investigations revealed their secret participation in foreign conflicts. Well, if you click on the link, where does it take you? Well, it takes you to this article. And it's The Guardian giving a huge boost to the websites Bellingcat and Insider, all about their success in revealing the identity of Russians connected with the so-called Novichok incident. It says, but in a series of blockbuster investigations, the online investigative journalism sites Bellingcat and The Insider presented a strong case to identify Bashirov as Colonel Chepiga, a highly decorated officer in the Russian military intelligence. And it said this, but after our first article, we had a number of people reaching out. This is Bellingcat talking now. After our first article, we had a number of people reaching out with additional information, and some of it was very specific. The main challenge then was fact-checking and verifying the information we were provided with. But Elliot Higgins added this when he was asked about these tips. He said he couldn't go into detail at this point.
Ah.
So the whole of the Guardian article about the mobile phones is spun to be propaganda that the Russians are up to something because they're doing this. And then he promotes these other sites who are using their own baseless information to make these claims, which not even the boss of the company wants to substantiate. Mm. So as always, let's meet the journalist. This is Andrew Roth. And I was very interested that on his Twitter page, he'd got this particular post. For Russia, the Kerch Bridge is the jewel pearl, and Russia will protect it severely. My story on Russia's blockade of the Ukraine ports. Directors say they've had no new ships for a week. Captains told wait for inspections or an inspection that never comes. So he's got a pinned tweet, which, of course, is effectively hammering the Russians. If you go down and look at comments, I was intrigued to find this. A person, KVK, said this: no ships for a week. Here is an excerpt from marinetraffic.com. Mariupol arrivals, and then there's a whole list of ships arriving. So somebody's immediately said, check your facts. But for me, this whole story, absolutely not credible from this journalist. And so can we believe anything that the mainstream media are now telling us? And I think the answer to that is no, we can't be entirely sure.
No.
So the government is going to protect the mainstream media, and it's going to make sure that so-called alternative media sites, free speech sites, can't be accessed by the public.
Mark, we're pretty much out of time, but look, let's just have one more go at discussing this issue of Chicago and the climate center. Just see if you can pick up from where you were, if you could.
Yeah, resilient Chicago. How am I coming through?
Well, you're coming through. That's obviously a different microphone.
Yeah, I changed it. I hope it's better. Basically, Rahm Emanuel is laying out, along with the Rockefeller Foundation's Michael Berkowitz, a very integrated plan to merge the interests of universities, merge the interests of hospitals, insurance companies, sports teams. All of it is being put in this unification plan, along with climate change, and everybody is having to march to the same drummer. The Rockefeller Foundation representative told the Chicago Council on Global Affairs that they're shooting for 100 resilient cities, and Chicago is the 50th worldwide out of 100. So the idea is that each city would have a commissar or a Rockefeller Foundation representative. And so the structure will be with this representative from the Rockefeller group. They'll all march to the same tune, sing out of the same hymnal, a little bit of local variation here and there, and some public relations going on, some, you know, local mass transit improvements, some energy efficiency improvements. Chicago's going to try to be completely alternative, renewable energy by the year 2035, for example, and they want to have their CTA bus fleet all electric, no fossil fuels by the year 2040. But these are some of the niceties of it. But it's really a command and control thing to put the public and private sectors in this merger mania and get all the cities that are involved reading off the same page through these Rockefeller representatives. So it's global governance is really getting into the minutiae of society is what it boils down to.
Is there any awareness of this within the U.S. Mainstream media or even the U.S. population?
Zero. I mean, guys, we are the only ones covering this, and I'm not exaggerating this. The Chicago Tribune, the Chicago Sun-Times are in bed with these people. To the extent the press does anything at all, they're involved in it, but they don't report on it. It's the same model as Bilderberg. They help with it. They nurture it. They're moderators at some of their presentations, but they're not actually sending reporters in and telling the people that the new constituency is corporations and sports teams and insurance companies and hospital conglomerates and things like this. The basic elements of democracy are just being mowed under in this global cities movement. It has some nice things about it in terms of, again, some efficiency improvements, some landscaping improvements, some outward cosmetic improvements here and there. It's maybe not all bad. But the restructuring of governance is just being completely put over on the people without their awareness. The average Chicagoan has no idea what's going on, and the same thing for their counterparts in other cities.
And of course, right at the heart of this, Mark, is the think tanks, and because they are producing much of this policy in the first place. And you had an article a week or so ago on the 21st Century Wire. Headline is Globalist Think Tanks Called on to Further Unite Lest They Lose Their Neoliberal Order. This is something which is clearly of concern. Many current and ex MPs and government, UK government officials, discussing the risks to the what they're describing as the what are they calling it, the global rules-based order. But what's your point here?
Well, Dr. Robin Niblett, the head of Chatham House, wrote an 11,000-word article. How many 11,000-word articles do you see in Foreign Policy or Foreign Affairs or all these journals of the establishment? Well, what he's saying is that the think tanks run the risk of becoming irrelevant because they're having to tackle issues when the sizzle is happening, right when they're happening, and they feel like they're becoming more like just another media, another news outlet. They're losing their ability and their shtick, which is usually to take the longer range view, to get into foundational long-term issues. Well, they find themselves being pulled away from that. Now they're reassessing their role. And they don't want to lose their grip on the long-term narrative, on the underlying themes of what's going on. So he's pretty nostalgic here about how the think tanks used to be in the good old days when they were controlling the narrative to get the U.S. involved in World War I, when they controlled the narrative to get the U.S. involved in World War II, and so on and so forth, and to consolidate the very things that led to what's happening in Chicago. But digressing a little bit, they're trying to keep their original mission in place, but still be relevant to current issues. So in order to do this balancing act, Niblett at Chatham House is calling on all the relevant globalist think tanks to unite their ideas and unite their narratives even more, which is pretty incredible because they're pretty united already, but to really, really solidify this and make it impermeable. And so as to keep their original mission of long-term manipulation, but also still be able to manipulate the news narrative in the here and now. But one of the interesting things that I'll part with this is he said, and this is an admission, quote, in the United States, think tanks became holding pens for future appointees to presidential administrations where they developed and honed their ideas for future policy. So what he admitted there was what the so-called conspiracy theorists have said all along, that the think tanks don't just have ideas that they clandestinely pump into governments. They put personnel into governments in a very strategic way so as to change the orientation of those governments and basically privatize them and, again, erase that distinction between the public and the private sectors. So this is an admission holding pens for future appointees to presidential administrations, is how Niblett described the major think tanks. That's what we've been saying all along. That's for what many years has been denied. But now he's admitting it, that they've had a very direct influence on government personnel, not just on white papers and studies and ideas.
And just very quickly, Mark, just add to that, we use the expression, or they're using the expression holding pen, but what's going on is these people are being reframed. These agendas are being driven into their minds. We could call it brainwashing if we wanted to use that expression. But these people are being seeded with political views and policies before they go into the elected position to put those policies into power.
Mark, just two words on this, if you could, because what you're describing there is they're effectively creating a cartel of think tanks. There's no competition between think tanks, and therefore no presentation of differing views. This is very much like the mainstream media, which is now running as a cartel. They're linking to each other's articles. They're reinforcing each other's narratives. There is no opportunity for any diversity within the views or the narratives that are being presented. So on a long-term basis, this is hugely dangerous.
Yeah, keep in mind that Chatham House is one of the original major think tanks. So for them to be saying this is very significant. They're kind of being the conductor while everyone else is the orchestra, is the way I see it. Yeah. And one thing that Niblett mentioned was think tanks have to apply a growing proportion of their resources to trying to mobilize popular engagement. One approach has been to raise their public profile, but the danger in this is that it blurs the line between think tanks and the media. But what's buried in that statement is the public is beginning not to believe the think tanks. See, this is also in my article about them and in his article that I'm talking about, that they're losing their convincing output. The public's just not as convinced by their narratives as they used to be. So yeah. they're closing ranks to try and keep their credibility and keep their influence. But at the same time, as you said, Mike, form what amounts to a cartel, or at least a roadway toward a cartel.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much, Mark.
Okay, that's it for... Sorry, thank you, Mark. That's it for today's UK Column News. Thank you very much for joining us. We would ask all of our viewers and listeners to help us spread the information that we're putting across in the news. That's one of the key things we want to do. As you know from today's news and the topics we've covered, it's quite clear that there is an ever encroaching clampdown on free media. So help to keep UK Column free, push out the information. We'll be back at the same time on Friday. Thanks for joining us.
Bye-bye.